This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. While we can't yet cure autism spectrum disorder for the majority of people diagnosed with it, access to early and intensive treatment offers a really good shot at reaching potential. To that end, Connecticut's Medicaid program is increasing their coverage for autism services, but the rules that accompany this expansion may make it harder, not easier, for people to get the services they need. To make it worse, recently requested budget reductions from a state program that allows young people diagnosed with both autism and mental illness to live with their families will further restrict access for the sickest. You can join the conversation 860-275-7266, comment on our website WNPR.org, or find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live as we talk about autism in America and in Connecticut today. Later, we'll be talking more about interventions that work and about what happens to young adults on the autism spectrum once they reach 18. If you or someone you know has autism, you're coping with the disorder, 860-275-7266. We'd love to hear from you today. You can, again, also tweet us at Where We Live. Joining us in studio is Donna Swanson, Executive Director of Focus Center for Autism. Donna, good to see you once again. Thanks so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Joining us also by phone is Deborah Fine, who's a professor of psychology at the University of Connecticut and editor of The Neuropsychology of Autism. Her book, The Activity Kit for Babies and Toddlers at Risk, How to Use Everyday Routines to Build Social and Communication Skills, will be out this fall. Deborah, welcome to our program. Thanks so much for coming.
Thank you so much.
And I want to welcome in Arielle Levin-Becker, who's the healthcare reporter for the Connecticut Mirror. You can find her work at ctmirror.org. And I'd like Arielle to start us off and talk us through some of the implications of budget cuts and other things that are happening at the state. Arielle, thanks for joining us once again. I appreciate it.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So first of all, Arielle, per federal requirements, Connecticut's Medicaid program is expanding coverage of services for young people with autism spectrum disorders. What exactly is this expansion expected to cover and who's going to benefit from this?
So what happened is a lot of this relates to coverage of behavioral therapies, such as applied behavioral analysis, which I'm guessing you're going to hear a lot about later. But just very briefly, it's a therapy for kids with autism. It's very intensive. Often kids receive or are suggested to receive, 30 or more hours a week. So it's pretty expensive and it's pretty intensive, but there's also evidence that suggests it can be pretty effective. And in the past, the state Medicaid program, which covers about one in four kids in Connecticut, in the past that program has not covered these services. This has also been an issue in other states. And so last summer, the federal government issued guidance to state Medicaid directors that essentially said, hey, guys, you have to cover this. Medicaid has a set of sort of screening, diagnostic, and treatment services that must be covered for kids and young adults up to age 21. And the federal government essentially said, for children and young people with autism spectrum disorders, you need to cover these things as well under that mandate. So Connecticut, like other states, went about expanding that coverage and developing regulations for providing coverage for people who have Medicaid to receive these services. And certainly advocates and treatment providers were pleased with this. The concern they had is that, as with most things, the devil's in the details. And here the proposed regulations that were issued by the Department of Social Services, according to advocates and according to some groups, the national groups like Autism Speaks, they found the regulations to be very restrictive. In some cases, some of the requirements were things that Autism Speaks that they've never seen in any other state, and that would effectively, in their mind, make it extremely difficult for anybody to qualify to receive services and make it extremely difficult for any people who are currently providing the services in Connecticut to actually qualify for Medicaid reimbursement. There were a lot of people who deliver the services now who said they wouldn't be considered a qualified provider under these regulations.
So it's a bit confusing, Arielle. It's an expansion that in practicality actually turns into something that might make it more difficult for people to get the services they need?
That's sort of what what the critics of these regulations are saying. They are proposed regulations. I mean, I believe they're sort of in effect until something is finalized, but they're sort of pending at the moment in terms of whether these will be the final regulations. But certainly there's a lot of concern from both sort of people who follow access to care and Medicaid, and also sort of people with expertise in autism who think that. On paper, there might be expanded coverage, but from a practical perspective, it could be very difficult for people to actually use the coverage.
And specifically, Medicaid only covering a certain number of hours of this ABA treatment that we'll hear more about, this applied behavior analysis treatment in RL. This is one of the issues coming up, a limit on some of this coverage that is so vital to people.
Yeah, there's a limit. I think it's a limit of 25 hours, or else there'd have to be they'd have to get approval to get more. Some of the other concerns are that there would be several rounds of getting authorization for coverage to receive the services. There are also some concerns about some of the requirements. For example, in the proposed regulation, it says that if Medicaid's going to cover this service, the caregiver or parent of the child would have to be present at all times. That services are provided, which, you know, groups like Autism Speaks and others have said, you know, this isn't consistent with, you know, the requirements for any other medical services. If you have a parent who works who might, you know, drop the kid off, or a parent who has other children, it would be very difficult. The regulations say that the reason for this requirement is to make sure that the Medicaid isn't paying for other things like respite services or babysitting, which aren't really technically able to be billed under Medicaid. But that's something that people have said really stands out and is really just sort of inconsistent with any other sort of medical coverage requirements. There are also some requirements about the people who provide the services. The regulation specifies that in order to provide services like applied behavioral analysis to someone in Medicaid, a qualified provider would have to have had certain college courses in very specific fields that are often not part of the educational program that people who do this receive. The alternative would be they would have to have gone through training with supervision by a licensed provider, which actually doesn't sound that stringent, except that in Connecticut, people who do applied behavioral analysis, who are often the people supervising people in training, there is no license for them. So that's where you see a lot of people who do this saying, you know, hey, under these regulations, I wouldn't qualify to provide this treatment.
Donna, from what I understand, you are licensed to provide this analysis?
No, we do a different kind of therapy.
You do a different kind of therapy?
Yeah, we do what's called, we do social learning, and it's called milieu therapy. It's a very old kind of therapy that it's a therapeutic community, or one of our kids calls a social incubator. So the kids are taught how to manage anxiety, how to process, how to have life skills, and learn how to make relationships and things like that. It's a different form. And one of the things I was told is that's supposed to be allowed under the new Medicaid Act.
But you're personally licensed to do the ABA. It's just not something that you do
no,
at your center.
No, I'm not licensed. I'm okay. a licensed nurse practitioner.
I want to get to Deborah just to flesh this out a little bit more. Can you explain how applied behavior analysis works, Deborah?
Sure. Well, the basics are that this is based on learning theory, and there are sort of two main ideas. One is that the children have to be taught specific tasks that they that in typical development they would have just picked up incidentally from the environment, but kids with autism and many other neurodevelopmental disabilities may not have picked these things up. So some of them would be social skills like making eye contact and looking for reactions of adults when you do something, or trying to master a skill and show the adult that you've mastered it, show the adult something interesting that you want to share with them. These would be, you know, very simple social skills. And then there are equally important things like language and self-help, self-care skills. So one of the basic tenets is that you do an analysis of the task that you want to teach, even as something as complicated language, and then you teach it step by step through imitation and prompting, and then fading out your prompts, and through positive reinforcement. And then the other half of it is to try to reduce interfering behavior. So if a child is doing a lot of what, you know, we call stimming or self-stimulation behavior, where they may just be staring at lights or ceiling fans or their fingers, these preoccupations are interfering with their ability to learn from the environment and from other people. So the idea is to reduce those behaviors by figuring out what is reinforcing or sustaining them, and then trying to take away the reinforcement.
Has this been shown in any way to actually cure autism in some kids?
Well, I think the word cure is kind of loaded, and I don't like to use it because autism is not really a disease that one can get cured from. But we are studying a group of children that have one particular form of what we call optimal outcome. There are many different kinds of optimal outcome, you know, depending on the child's capabilities. But we are studying a group of children who have lost the diagnosis. They've really lost all the symptoms. They're socially indistinguishable from kids who never had autism. And the kids in our study are all either mainstreamed in regular school with no one-on-one assistance. Some of them are in college. And we did find when we looked back at their treatment histories that many more of them got ABA very early than the kids who were, you know, cognitively doing very well, very high functioning, but still quite autistic. And I think one thing that's really important, you know, per this discussion, is how early the kids in our, quote, optimal outcome group got their ABA. The biggest difference was between age 2 to 2.5 and 2.5 to 3. And at 2.5 to 3, about 55% to 60% of our optimal outcome kids did get ABA, and only 7% of the high-functioning autism group got ABA. So the very earliest treatment in the early intervention birth to three system is really important for outcome.
And the treatment needs to be early, but it's also very intensive once you undergo it, something like 30 to 40 hours recommended per week. Deborah, how does this rub up against some of the limitations under this Medicaid program that Ariel was talking about before?
That's a really good question. You can't, you know, the general literature is supporting up to 40 hours a week. I'm sorry, I'm hearing some beeping. I hope you can still hear me.
Yes.
The general literature is supporting up to 40 hours a week, but for very little kids, they really can't tolerate 40 hours a week because they take naps, they get bored. So you really have to partly reduce the number of hours, to certainly not more than 25 to 30 for a two-year-old. And then you have to change the format a little bit so that it's more play-based, rather than having the child, you know, you can't expect obviously a two-year-old to be sitting at a table doing lessons, which you can't expect from an older kid. Hmm. Once they turn three and move into the public school system, then they really should be getting as many hours as possible, you know, even up to 40. You know, if the source of payment is going to be coming from Medicaid, then putting a limit of 25 hours, you know, is definitely not a good thing.
Donna, from your experience, how hard is it as a provider to get Medicaid to cover the services you provide?
Well, we take Husky insurance, and they've been wonderful for us. It's the young adults that are really the ones that we're going to have problems with.
Yeah. And do these new Medicaid rules affect you in any way in the work that you do?
They're supposed to help us, but we're having problems getting through and being approved as a provider. It's not an easy system to access as a provider.
And why so?
I think it's just a complicated bureaucratic. It's new, and they haven't worked out all the kinks yet. But there are people that are supposedly available to help us, and I want to believe that.
Before we go to break, I want to ask another question of Ariel Levin-Becker. Obviously, this Medicaid expansion and the complications therein, one of the things we want to talk about, but also we've been seeing significant budget cuts coming at the state level, including a cut to the voluntary services program run by DCF. Can you just explain, Ariel, what this program is and how the proposed cuts could affect people on the autism spectrum?
Sure. The cut actually applies to the voluntary services program run by the Department of Developmental Services, and that's available. It generally serves families of young people between ages 8 to 21. And it's for kids who have a diagnosis of either autism or another intellectual disability, as well as a mental health diagnosis and generally behaviors that are very challenging and disruptive, often things that would make it very difficult for that child to live at home with a family. And so one of the goals of the program is to keep them in the home rather than in an institution or sort of a different type of setting. And so often families receive very intensive services, again, 20 to 30 hours a week, not necessarily things like ABA, but people who can come sort of provide help, can help the young person with activities. In a lot of cases, these are really families at breaking points who, are in really, really difficult spots with often teenagers who are sort of have grown to the point that it's very difficult to sort of control them if necessary. Sometimes they have outbursts that can be violent. So it's very difficult for families. And the people I've heard from and spoken to in the program, describe it as often a real lifeline. The program costs the state about $32 million a year, some of which is reimbursed by the federal government. Under the governor's proposed budget, the program would lose $20 million. It would be about a 60% cut.
And again, this serves not thousands of kids. It's somewhere upwards of 500 kids in this program. But as you've suggested, Ariel, these are people who really need these particular services very, very badly, and this cut could really mean a huge problem for this program.
Right. It last I heard, it was about 543 families in the program. And when I spoke to the governor's budget director, one of the reasons he cited for cutting this particular program is that it's not income-based. So it's not exclusively available to people who are low income. But as you said, these are very high-need families. Even if they have a lot of resources, it can be very difficult to self-fund, people who could come in and help. I mean, you really need people who are pretty high skill and highly trained to help out in these situations.
Aria Levin-Becker covers health and healthcare for the Connecticut Mirror. You can read more at ctmirror.org. Ariel, it's always great to have you here. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, John.
When we come back, we're going to take some of your calls about autism and also hear from someone with autism spectrum disorder about what it's like to live in his shoes. You can join us at 860-275-7266. If you have questions or thoughts, we'd like to hear from you as well on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. The number of people who need treatment for autism spectrum disorder is increasing every year. The CDC estimates 1 in 68 people have autism spectrum disorder today. That's up from about 1 in 150 a decade ago. So we're talking about today in the program, 860-275-7266. You can comment on our website, WNPR.org. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. Joining us in the studio today is Donna Swanson, Executive Director for Focus Center for Autism. We'll be talking more about their programs in just a moment. Deborah Fine is Professor of Psychology at the University of Connecticut and the Editor of the Neuropsychology of Autism. I want to welcome in Dan Lanois, who works for Focus in their mentoring program and is a team leader for their Spectrum Unplugged panel. Dan was diagnosed with autism spectrum disorder when he was 8 years old. And Dan, welcome to our program. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
I'm wondering if you can tell us what symptoms led to your diagnosis at the age of eight.
Well, as far as symptoms go, I was to be going into public school at the age of six as normal, and I think one of the things my parents in the school noticed was that I wasn't fitting in socially. Like forever kids, social skills come very naturally at that age. You're expected to kind of immerse yourself in social groups, that kind of thing. And while I was doing very well academically, the social skills was really starting to become a problem. I was having trouble fitting in with other kids my age. The teachers didn't really understand that because at the time, autism was not as well known as it is now. Back then, autism was pretty much just in the back of any handbook for a psychiatrist. It really wasn't very well known as it is today. So the services at the time really weren't available. So my parents ended up self-diagnosing me. And because of the, my mom would know more about the exact symptoms, but certainly the, social dysfunction was number one.
So what began to happen once you're diagnosed at this fairly early age, later than some we've heard, but earlier than many people, what were some treatments that began to help and to work for you?
Well, we tried a few different treatments, and now we had to private pay for all of these because back then providers weren't really covering autism as they were a lot of other mental disorders. We did try, I think, some speech therapies and some like physical therapies, I believe, that kind of helped me that way. And we did try a few different occupational like centers before Focus, and they just weren't providing the type of help that I needed specifically, which was social skill based. And that's coming to Focus when I was 8, that has really helped me a lot.
Can you talk about what sort of things help in helping you develop social skills? Because obviously that's, as you said, I think quite rightly, at that age, kids begin to develop naturally this ability. And so you probably needed help, and you also probably saw yourself as someone on the outside of a lot of conversations that were happening in school and elsewhere. Can you just tell me about that, what that was like for you at the time?
Well, that's really the difficult thing, because that put a lot of and this kind of adds into the anxiety part of autism, because kids on the spectrum, I think, are naturally anxious because there is that lack of communication. I see a group of kids in school. I don't know, they can come up to me, they can kind of start a conversation, but I don't know what's going on through their heads. I don't know what they're thinking. I don't know what they're talking about. For many other people, it's like in a Lego video game. You'll see like those little balloons over people's heads or something. You'll see those kind of cartoonist kind of representations. But for when you're someone on the spectrum, it's like those balloons are just missing. You don't really get those indicators what people are saying, and so that puts a lot of stress, because it's like, do I say this? Do I say that? What? How do I respond? And at the time, I didn't really know how to do that. So what was great about going to Focus is Focus kind of helped bridge that gap. It helped kind of show you, introduce myself into those social settings, while at the same time not putting any stress on me in that process.
Donna, could you explain some of that work and what exactly it is you're trying to do to help him and others develop these social skills?
Well, what we do is we have a kind of a schedule, a routine, and they know exactly what to expect from when they're in therapy, basically, from the moment they walk in to the moment they leave. But it's called Life 101. And so they are constantly, it's social learning all the time. We help guide them through social relationships, how to manage their anxiety. Anxiety is like key. We deal with behavior after we deal with anxiety, because the more anxiety you have, the more behavior you have. So we need a customer. So that's one of the things that makes us a little different than some places, that we make sure that we have a customer. And so we have sensory programs as part of our routine. We also have employed people who are on the spectrum. Dan started at 8 and earned his way up to being a paid staff. I do have to say, when Dan first started, he didn't come out of the car. Then he went into locked himself into the shed. Then he locked himself into the bathroom. And now he is at he's taking college courses. He's the team leader. He's the mentor. He's the role model for all the kids. But it's social learning. We call it creatively wired and socially challenged, and it's about relationships. So they need, and we provide a continuum of care so that people are from young to old. They're inspired by each other, and it really is kind of a magical place.
I have to say, Dan, you were laughing when she was describing
it's true.
It was like, and when you think back to yourself at that time, I mean, what do you think when you remember those days?
Well, it's true. She knows it's true. We've been down this road. It's kind of just funny to look back. It's funny to me because we go on panels and presentations across the state, so I often hear the story kind of thrown back at me, and it's kind of funny looking back, but it's true. And there's an important factor behind that, is that that a lot of the reasons for, well, me hiding in the shed and hiding in the bathroom the second week, a lot of it was due to stress and anxiety, and that is a very core part of the kind of social dysfunction that I think a lot of the kids and teens and young adults on the spectrum go through, that I think a lot of people don't understand, is it's not necessarily about the autism. It's often about the anxiety that comes from autism. Mm. It's like a chain. There are many interlinking factors, and I think the anxiety before you treat the before you even start to focus on the autism related issue, you have to, like Donna said, you have to focus on the anxiety. You have to have a customer.
And you have to have a relationship.
Exactly.
We're talking with some folks from Focus Center for Autism here on the program today, and we also have a guest who's an expert in the field. I want to take some phone calls, though. People want to join us at 860-275-7266. Christopher's on the line. Christopher's, I think, calling from Florida. Hi, Christopher. Go ahead. You're on Where We Live.
Yes. Good afternoon or good morning. We adopted my son when he was 2 years old from Russia. And we've been struggling, you know, from day one, and had been diagnosed somewhere on the autism scale, the spectrum, in certain respects, very high functioning, which is very frustrating. We've spent God knows how much money and resources right up to a specialized school. And it just seems when they're in that specialized environment where they're kind of catered to, he did okay. But as soon as he came out back into the real world and had to function in, you know, the hard reality and social settings of a normal school, he reverted right back to his old ways. And it was funny hearing about a young man running in the shed, because that was my son, always hiding behind a smartphone, hiding in his room when we have company. Just that inability to just smile is very frustrating, no matter how much we try to impart upon him. Just how you carry yourself, a simple smile would make you more acceptable socially, but hard to get there.
Have you found any therapies or treatments that work for your son, Christopher?
Been to probably the leading brain psychiatrist in Palm Beach, tried many different cocktails. We're on a new drug just started this week, I guess Risperidol, I believe, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, and we are now looking into a specialized school. I mean, he's 19. He was going to the state school here and felt he couldn't make it, so he was dropped out of there, and we just don't know what to do.
Mm. Well, Christopher, first of all, thank you very much for sharing the story. And just to hang on the line there, because I want to ask Deborah Fine about that. And Deborah, I'm sure you could hear what Christopher was saying. I'm sure that this is a story that you've heard quite often. What do you say to someone like Christopher who seemingly tried everything and now has a son at 19 who really hasn't shown the progress that he'd hoped for?
Well, one issue that's really important for people to understand is that when you get a diagnosis of autism, there's a huge range of clinical presentations that can describe. And kids who are adopted from Eastern European orphanages, they do often show some autistic features, but they have a whole different presentation frequently because of the early severe deprivation that most of them came to this country with. Some of those kids who were adopted from conditions of severe deprivation, some of them do extremely well, and others just never get over that severe early deprivation. But those conditions probably have a different cause than what you would typically see in a young child who's diagnosed with autism. In terms of general therapies, I think what Dan was saying and his mom was extremely interesting, that if you have a young man who's, you know, very cognitively either average or superior, but has anxiety or has, emotional disturbance or has primarily social disturbance, then different kinds of treatments are going to be effective than what we're talking about for a young, very language-delayed 2 or 3 year old. For the young man who's adopted from Russia, you know, I would say they should find someone who specializes in those adoption cases. He might have what's called reactive attachment disorder, rather than maybe an autism specialist, because different kinds of treatments might be effective for him. And then there are some kids who really need very continuous support that you might get from a special school and really are not going to be able to be mainstreamed in a regular school.
I have to ask you, Deborah, we hear about this number, 1 in 68 children. Just a few years ago, I did a program very similar to this, and the number that the CDC was talking about was 1 in 100. And 10 years ago, it was 1 in 150. Are we actually seeing autism and autism spectrum disorders on the rise, or does this have to do with a better diagnosis? What exactly is the cause of this number spike?
Right. Well, that's a great question. When I was trained, it was like 1 in 3,000. Mm-hmm. So it's the prevalence has really changed tremendously. The short answer is that I don't think we have any good idea of what's happening. One possibility is that the prevalence or the incidence really is going up. But it can't, but the cause of autism clearly is genetic in many cases, and we can't have changes in genetic inheritance over just 20 years. That's not happening. So one possibility is increased awareness, broadening of the diagnostic criteria, what's called diagnostic substitution, where a child who has cognitive dysfunction maybe would have gotten a diagnosis of mental retardation or intellectual disability. Now people instead are focusing on the autism behavior and giving them an autism diagnosis. There are some personality disorders that are now being called autism. So I think there are many factors, and one of the experts in this area, Eric Fombone, has written that the way you actually ascertain that 1 in 68 number is so different from state to state, the way the Centers for Disease Control do it, the CDC in Atlanta, the way local special ed departments do it, the way physicians, you know, who are diagnosing, or psychologists who are diagnosing two-year-olds do it. They're so different that you're going to have very different prevalence figures.
Mm. I want to get to another phone call quickly. If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. Sammy is calling from Manchester. Hello,
yes.
Sammy.
Hello. Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm a deep person, so please listen to me carefully. My opinion to the governor is that he shouldn't cut the resources for these guys. I mean, I'm a parent, and my son is severely autistic. He can't talk. He has changed my life entirely. If any cut is going to be a problem, even not being a cut, my son receives only 1 hour a week. It doesn't make much difference in his life. When he started, it is working fine. But even 1 hour a week doesn't even work fine.
Hey, and I just want to make sure I understand, Sammy. So your son has difficulty speaking, and you take part in these ABA programs that we were talking about earlier?
Yes. They say that they will only give him 1 hour a week.
1 hour a week, and how many hours a week does he need to get effective treatment?
The doctor says at least 25 to 40 hours a week.
Hmm.
The doctor, I have a note right in my hand that says he needs to get. My second question is to the counselor is that how do you know this person qualified to give a service to a child? Because what I'm seeing is that most of them work under some of the agents which are the licensed to do it. So most who come home may not have the licenses to treat the kids, and they may give something wrong to them. So how do you know that this person who is taking care of my son or somebody's son is qualified to deliver that service
The
person?
That's a very good question. And Sammy, I wish you best of luck in getting services for your son. It's a great few questions. I'll ask you, Donna, since you're here, how do people get licensed to provide autism services? I mean, how exactly does that work, to Sammy's question?
Well, there's a lot of different people that provide autism services, and they can be psychologists, they can be nurses, they can be social workers. There are centers that provide autism that specialize in autism, and there's a couple of places that you can go look up online, like the Autism Association for it's ASRC, that has a list of providers and a list of services. It really, you need to use your internet and then call up and join a support group. Support groups are families helping families, and I think that is one of the most powerful, if there's a support group in your area, because that the parents are the warriors. They're the ones that know exactly who's around, who's helped, who hasn't, and they support each other, and with support you can make it.
Well, one of the things, Deborah, though, that I think I hear whenever I have conversations like this is, unlike other things that we need to treat, whether or not it's a broad spectrum like autism spectrum disorder or a specific disease, it seems as though here there's a lot of different doors that you can walk through because there's so many different types of services people might need. Is that right? I mean, is it true to say that there's not one path that someone might take to get services for their child?
absolutely. So most of the children that I see, so we're doing an early detection project, most of the kids that I see are age anywhere from 15 months to 4 years at diagnosis, and most of them have very significant delays, and they need very intensive treatment. For virtually all of those children, I recommend ABA. And the certification for ABA, it's called a board-certified behavior analyst, a BCBA. Those people have taken a national licensing exam and passed it. They have good training. Now, the individual therapists who provide the therapy don't need to be BCBAs, but they need to be supervised by such a person. So that's one thing that you can ask, is whether the service provider or the supervisor of the service provider has a BCBA. But as Dan was talking about, if you have an older, you know, a teenager or a young adult, they may need cognitive behavioral therapy or social skills training for social skills or for anxiety. And then you might want a licensed psychologist or a licensed social worker or a nurse practitioner who does psychiatric treatment. So it really depends what the needs are. I'm wondering where your recent caller was calling from, because there are many states where I hear parents say, you know, they can get an hour a week. That's what they've been approved for. And I think that's just terrible. I think you're missing a tremendous opportunity if there's a young child who can get an hour a week. That's one reason that we're, you know, going ahead with this book that's going to give parents at least, it's not equivalent to professional intervention, but it will be at least a way to supplement the professional intervention hours.
And again, our caller, Sammy, was calling from Manchester, Connecticut, I believe. Just very quickly, Deborah, I just have one last question for you. We talked about the prevalence of autism spectrum disorder, but something that's also baffling is, why does it seem to affect so many more boys than girls, and so much more deeply boys than girls? What do we know about that?
It's not really more deeply. There's actually, if you look at the gender ratio, the sex ratio, as you get lower and lower cognitive function and more severe, the gender ratio kind of equalizes out. It's at the very, very highest functioning that you tend to get many more boys. We don't know the answer to that. That's my answer to a lot of your questions. We don't know the answer to that. Yeah. But it is true that boys are differentially affected by many medical illnesses and many neurodevelopmental disorders. So it's not special to autism that boys are more affected.
Deborah Fine is a professor of psychology at the University of Connecticut, editor of the Neuropsychology of Autism. Her book, The Activity Kit for Babies and Toddlers at Risk, will be out this fall. Deborah, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
When we come back, we'll be talking more with our guests in studio and also talking about work programs for those on the autism spectrum disorder as adults. If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up tomorrow, last week we heard from State Comptroller Kevin Lembo that we've got a budget deficit of more than $170 million this year. It means more cuts. So our weekly news roundtable, The Wheelhouse, will once again discuss our ongoing state of permanent fiscal crisis. We'll bring in an expert, an analyst, the Connecticut Mirror's state budget guru, Keith Faniff, to help out me and Colin McEnroe. Hopefully we can get to the bottom of some of these things. That's coming up tomorrow, Where We Live. Today on the program, we're talking about autism. You can join us at 860-275-7266. Joining me in studio, Donna Swanson, executive director for Focus Center for Autism, and Dan Lanois, who works for Focus in their mentoring program and is a team leader for their Spectrum Unplugged panel. Dan was diagnosed with autism spectrum disorder when he was 8 years old. Before we get to our next guest, Don, I just want to ask you about something we were just talking about, some of the developmental milestones that you see in your work that are so very, very important. I mean, we talk about early intervention. You are seeing people who are diagnosed for the very first time all throughout their age spectrum, let alone the autism spectrum. What are some of those developmental milestones that are so important?
In terms of what the kids, they have a lot of stress when they turn 13, just being a teenager, 16, they feel like they should have a license and a girlfriend. At 18, they're thinking about graduating from high school and what's next. At 19, they're mourning the loss of being a teenager. And at 21, they're really stressed out because they're supposed to be an adult and have their whole lives together. And the kids, the people that I work with tend to be more mid to higher on the spectrum. And they're very, very hard on themselves. It's the anxiety, the expectations. They want to fit in. They want to be understood. The relationships, they want girlfriends. They want to be able to connect with their world in a meaningful way, and it's just not happening for them.
Dan, does this all sound right to you?
I would say so. I think that matches me up pretty well.
but it also sounds to me like an awful lot of the same pressures that all kids face. Like, I remember all of these milestones myself, but maybe put it into some context for us and how maybe it affected you differently than the kids you were growing up with.
Well, I think young adults on the spectrum, I think, are just like any other young adults. I don't think that you should put them on any different comparison, because when it all boils down to it, we're all young adults too. We all go through that same struggles. We all want a girlfriend, boyfriend, whatever. We all want to kind of graduate high school, go to college, or find work. There's an enormous amount of stress in that part of life, and adding on to that, well, when you're on the spectrum, it kind of just makes it a little bit more difficult to decide where you want to go, because a lot of the guys on the spectrum kind of have their own life plan kind of set out for them where they want to go, but they don't always know how they want to get there. Mm-hmm. So it's a process. How you get to your destination is just as important as the destination.
What is your plan? What do you hope to do?
Well, my plan is I'm enjoying working with Focus. I mean, I wouldn't dare say anything else with Donna here, but I really do enjoy, I really do enjoy it. It's really, really a blast. I love working with the kids, and it's just a great feeling working with other kids a little bit younger who went through the same kind of struggles that I went through. And I also on the side I work with a games review site online. So.
We want to talk with somebody next who works with people on the autism spectrum disorder, working in the working field as young adults. Rajesh Anandan is the co-founder of Ultra Testing and SVP UNICEF Ventures. Rajesh, welcome to our program. Thanks so much.
Thank you, John. Thanks for having me.
So you're building a business model around people on the spectrum. What exactly is this business, and what makes it so well suited for people with autism spectrum disorder?
So Ultra is a New York-based technology company, and we provide a high-quality, highly responsive software testing service to clients in a number of industries, including advertising, media, technology, and so on. And we employ folks with Asperger's syndrome or similar autism spectrum profiles as software testers as part of the teams that are responsible for working with clients and delivering results.
And this works because the people that you're hoping to get into your workforce have specific skills and exactly what you need.
So I'd maybe say less skills and more abilities and traits. And I say that because, you know, we don't look at a resume. We do look at a resume, but we don't rely on it for much. Partly because, and I think this goes for any job, resumes tell you maybe what someone has done in the past. They don't tell you much about how someone works, what they're capable of, and it's just not an efficient way to try to assess how someone's going to do in a job. So we look for people who have great sort of raw talent and abilities around things like pattern recognition, logical reasoning, the ability to focus, someone who has great attention to detail, those kinds of things. And we have a series of assessments and tests and training that's part of our recruiting process that allows us to get a better sense, sort of a predictive model almost, of a candidate's profile and as it fits to the things we're looking for. And we have a list of about 40 traits and abilities that we're looking for. Some of them, and the things I mentioned, are very specific to the things that make for a great software tester, and we've now been successful at finding great software testers by recruiting folks who have Asperger's. Other things that we look for, like the ability to persevere through challenges or being helpful to team members, these are just good things no matter what job you're doing in, and the kinds of things that you want in a person on any team. And together, that sort of profile is the person we're looking for. And today, about 80% of our team have Asperger's or similar profiles. And we pair our testers with technology project managers who've got deep experience, and this is where experience matters, working in the industries that we're serving as clients and have a fair bit of experience in managing fast-paced technology projects. Mm-hmm. And there, it's the experience that matters as much as the kind of person that we're looking for. Whereas with the testers, we're looking for raw talent of people who can do the job better than anyone else. And we've had success so far in delivering a service that has, we've measured this advantage, the advantage of having a truly diverse workforce. And for us, on an average day, we detect over 20% more bugs than most vendors do as we work for clients. On a really good day, we'll detect 56% more bugs. That's sort of our measured advantage in how we do this better than others because of the diversity of our workforce.
That's so interesting. Rajesh Anandan, co-founder of Ultra Testing and SVP UNICEF Ventures, thank you so much for sharing the story with us. It's fascinating, and I wish you best of luck.
Thank you, John.
I want to ask both of you before we run out of time. I mean, we just heard that story about a business that is looking to build off of people's strengths, not treating this as some sort of a disability, but actually saying, here's things that people can do. Can you talk about some of the struggles and maybe some of the pathways for young adults to get into the workforce that you've noticed, maybe some things that you hope maybe can make it easier for people to get into the workforce, Donna?
Well, I think that's a fascinating story that he just told, and I'm so glad that there's somebody out there doing that. Our guys are really, really good employees if somebody is willing to hire them. They have very unique talents. They are very gifted, but what sometimes gets in the way is their lack of a resume or their lack of social skills. So when you interview them, that's why I was very interested in his profile and that he's looking at abilities, not skills. And that's really key. If you look at our guys and their abilities are tremendous. If you look at their skills, not so much. But if you have somebody that's willing to take their abilities and mentor them, the sky's the limit.
And Dan, we just have a few minutes left. But this idea of looking at you for your abilities is something that, I mean, I could see you nodding your head as you were listening to Rajesh talk about this. It's probably something very important if you're going for a job interview, if you're looking to get a career.
Well, yes, and I think it's a very innovative way of doing business. I really like it. In fact, I just ran across a similar news story that Microsoft was the software computer company that they were doing. They were hiring, like, I think 10 employees on the spectrum for their bug fix team, if you will, their software patch team, and it's just really a great idea because if you think about it, what better industry to open up to people on the spectrum than the coding and software division? Because like a lot of the guys that I work with, a lot of the people on the spectrum, you'll notice, are very good with math. They're very good with computer coding, that kind of thing. And they're very. What's interesting about them as employees is they're very committed. I could think of one of the guys that lives in one of our group homes who could spend probably all day and all night spent working on code. So if you're looking for someone to hire, I think that's a good populist target.
And it is so interesting and really, really looking at the things that people are good at and sort of looking past some of the things that may be problems in a job interview.
Exactly.
I will say, Dan, we were talking beforehand about social anxiety and about anxiety about being in the radio. You didn't seem to have any anxiety at all. One of the things you do is you talk to large groups of people, and I really appreciate you talking to our audience about this today. I really do appreciate
you
coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Dan Lanois works for Focus in their mentoring program. He's a team leader for their Spectrum Unplugged panel. Donna Swanson is executive director for Focus Center for Autism. Donna, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you for having us.
And on our website, WNPR.org, we'll make sure we put links to some of the services and things that we talked about on the program today. Betsy Kaplan produced our show today. Our executive producer is Katie Talarski. Thanks also to Lydia Brown, Tucker Ives, Kyle Wolf, and Josh Nalea. I'm John Dankosky. This is Where We Live.